This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present Harrow the Ninth by Tamsin Muir, narrated by Maura Quirk. For Issa Yap, who understood Harrow too well, and without whom so much of me would not have happened, and for P.T. Dramatis Personae. The Emperor of the Nine Houses, A.L., his guardian, struck through. Augustine the First, Alfred Quinque, his cavalier, struck through. First saint to serve the king undying. Mercy Morn the First, Christabel Oct, her cavalier, struck through. Second saint to serve the king undying. Autus the First, Pyrrha de Vey, his cavalier, struck through. Third saint to serve the king undying. Cassiopeia the First, struck through. Nigella Shodash, her cavalier, struck through. Fourth saint to serve the king undying. Cyrus the First, struck through. Valency Trinit, his cavalier, struck through. Fifth saint to serve the king undying. Ulysses the First, struck through. Titania Tetra, his cavalier, struck through. Sixth saint to serve the king undying. Cytherea the First, struck through. Loveday Heptane, her cavalier, struck through. Seventh saint to serve the king undying. Anastasia the First, struck through. Samael Novenary, her cavalier, struck through. Ianthe the First, Nabirius Turn, her cavalier, struck through. Eighth saint to serve the king undying. Harrow Hark the First, ninth saint to serve the king undying. One for the emperor, first of us all. One for his lictors who answered the call. One for his saints who were chosen of old. One for his hands and the swords that they hold. Two is for discipline, heedless of trial. Three for the gleam of a jewel or a smile. Four for fidelity, facing ahead. Five for tradition and debts to the dead. Six for the truth over solace in lies. Seven for beauty that blossoms and dies. Eight for salvation no matter the cost. Nine for the tomb and for all that was lost. Prologue. The night before the Emperor's murder. Your room had long ago plunged into near complete darkness, leaving no distraction from the great rocking thump, thump, thump of body after body flinging itself onto the great mass already coating the hull. There was nothing to see. The shutters were down. But you could feel the terrible vibration, hear the groan of chitin on metal, the cataclysmic rending of steel by fungus claw. It was very cold. A fine shimmer of frost now coated your cheeks, your hair, your eyelashes. In that smothering dark, your breath emerged as wisps of wet grey smoke. Sometimes you screamed a little, which no longer embarrassed you. You understood your body's reaction to the proximity. Screaming was the least of what might happen. God's voice came very calmly over the comm. 10 minutes until breach. We've got half an hour of aircon left. After that, you'll be working in the oven. Doors down until the pressure equalizes. Conserve your temp, everyone. Harrow, I'm leaving yours closed as long as possible. You staggered to your feet, limpid skirts gathered in both hands, and picked your way over to the comm button. Scanning for something damning and intellectual to say, you snapped, I can take care of myself. Harrow Hark, we need you in the river, and while you are in the river, your necromancy will not work.
I am a lictor, Lord, you heard yourself say. I am your saint. I am your fingers and gestures. If you wanted a hand who needed a door to hide behind, even now, then I have misjudged you.
From his far-off sanctum deep within the Mithraeum, you heard him exhale. You imagined him sitting in his patchy, worn-out chair, all alone, worrying his right temple with the thumb he always worried his right temple with. After a brief pause, he said,
Harrow, please don't be in such a hurry to die.
Do not underestimate me, teacher, you said. I have always lived. You picked your way back through the concentric rings of ground acetabula you had laid, the fine gritty layers of femur, and you stood in the centre and breathed. Deep through the nose, deep out the mouth, just as you had been taught. The frost was already resolving into a fine dew, misting your face and the back of your neck, and you were hot inside your robes. You sat down with your legs crossed and your hands laid helplessly in your lap. The basket hilt of the rapier nudged into your hip like an animal that wanted feeding, and in a sudden fit of temper, you considered unbuckling the damn thing and hurling it as hard as you possibly could to the other side of the room. Only you worried how pitifully short it would fall. Outside, the hull shuddered as a few hundred more heralds assembled on its surface. You imagined them crawling over one another, blue in the shadow of the asteroids, yellow in the light of the nearest star. The doors to your quarters slid open with an antique exhalation of gas levers. But the intruder did not set off the traps of teeth you'd embedded in its frame, nor the gobbets of regenerating bone you had gummed onto the threshold. She stepped over the threshold, with her cobwebby skirts rucked high on her thighs, teetering like a dancer. In the darkness, her rapier was black, and the bones of her right arm gleamed an oily gold. You closed your eyes to her.
"I could protect you if you'd only ask me to," said Ianthe the First.
A tepid trickle of sweat ran down your ribs.
"I would rather have my tendons peeled from my body one by one and flossed to shreds over my broken bones," you said. "I would rather be flayed alive and wrapped in salt. I would rather have my own digestive acid dripped into my eyes."
"So what I'm hearing is, maybe," said Ianthe.
"Help me out here. Don't be coy.
Do not pretend to me that you're here for anything other than to look after an investment." She said,
"I came to warn you."
"You came to warn me?" Your voice sounded flat and affectless, even to you.
"You came to warn me now?"
The other lictor approached. You did not open your eyes. You were surprised to hear her crunch through your metrical overlay of bone, to kneel without flinching on the grim and powdery carpet beneath her. You would never sense Ianthe's thanagy, but the darkness seemed to give you an immense attunement to her fear. You felt the hairs rise on the back of her forearms. You heard the hammering of her wet and human heart, her scapulae drawing together as she tensed her shoulders. You smelled the reek of sweat and perfume, musk, rose, vetiver.
"No, Nagesimus, nobody is coming to save you. Not God, not Augustine. Nobody."
There was no mockery in her voice now, but there was something else. Excitement, perhaps? Or unease?
"You'll be dead within the first half hour. You're a sitting duck. Unless there's something in one of those letters I don't know about, you're out of tricks."
"I have never been murdered before, and I truly don't intend to start now."
"It's over for you, Nona Jesimus. This is the end of the line."
You were shocked into opening your eyes when you felt the girl opposite cup your chin in her hands, her fingers febrile compared to the chilly shock of her gilded metacarpal, and put her meat thumb at the corner of your jaw. For a moment, you assumed that you were hallucinating, but that assumption was startled away by the cool nearness of her, of Ianthe Tridentarius on her knees before you in unmistakable supplication.
Her pallid hair fell around her face like a veil, and her stolen eyes looked at you with half-beseeching, half-contemptuous despair. Blue eyes with deep splotches of light brown, like agate. Looking deep into the eyes of the cavalier she murdered, you realized, not for the first time, and not willingly, that Ianthe Tridentarius was beautiful. "Turn around," she breathed. "Harry, all you have to do is turn around. I know what you've done, and I know how to reverse it, if only you'd ask me to. Just ask. It's that easy. Dying is for suckers. With you and me at full power, we could rip apart this resurrection beast and come away unscathed. We could save the galaxy, save the Emperor. Let them talk back home of Ianthe and Harrowhark. Let them weep to speak of us. The past is dead, and they're both dead, but you and I are alive. What are they? What are they, other than one more corpse we're dragging behind us?" Ianthe's lips were cracked and red. There was naked entreaty on her face. Excitement, then, not unease. This was, as you understood it dimly, the psychological moment. "Go fuck yourself," you said. The heralds came plopping down onto the hull like rain. Ianthe's face froze back into its white and mocking mask, and she dropped your jaw, untangled her restless fingers and her awful gold-shod bones. "I didn't think this was the time for dirty talk, but I can roll with it," she said. "Choke me, Daddy." "Get out!" "You always did think obstinacy the cardinal virtue," she remarked, quite apropos of nothing. "I think now, perhaps, you should have died back at Canaan House." "You should have killed your sister," you said. "Your eyes don't match your face." Over the comm, the Emperor's voice came, just as calm as before. 4 minutes until impact." And, like a tutor chiding inattentive children, "Make sure you're in place, girls." Ianthe turned away without violence. She stood and trailed her human fingers over the wall of your quarters, over the cool filigreed archway, over the polished metal panels and inlaid bone, and said, "Well, I tried, and therefore no one should criticize me," before ducking through the arch to the foyer beyond. You heard the door shut behind her. You were left profoundly alone. The heat rose. The station must have been completely smothered, wrapped in a squirming shroud of thorax and wing, mandible and antenna, the dead couriers of a hungry stellar revenant. Your communicator crackled with static, but there was only silence at the other end. There was silence in the lovely passageways of the Mithraeum, and there was a hot and sweating silence in your soul. When you screamed without sound, your throat muscles gulping mutely. You thought about the flimsy envelope addressed to you that read, "To open, in case of your imminent death."
"They're breaching," said the Emperor. "Forgive me, and give it hell, children."
Somewhere far off on the station, there was a warping crunch of plex and metal. Your knees became jelly, and you would have collapsed to the floor in a spasm had you not been sitting. With your fingers you closed your eyes, and you wrestled yourself into stillness. The darkness got darker and cooler as the first shield of perpetual bone cocooned you. The act of a fool, meaningless, doomed to dissolve the moment you submerged, then the second, then the third, until you were lost in an airless and impregnable nest. Throughout the Mithraeum, 5 pairs of eyes closed in concert, one of them yours. Unlike theirs, yours would not open again. In half an hour, no matter what teacher might hope, you would be dead.
The lictors of the resurrecting emperor began their long wade into the river to where the resurrection beast squatted, just out of the orbit of the Mithraeum, half alive, half dead, a verminous liminal mass. And you waded with them, but your meat you left vulnerably behind.
I pray the tomb is shut forever, you heard yourself saying aloud, and you could not bring your voice above a choked whisper. I pray the rock is never rolled away. I pray that which was buried remains buried, insensate, in perpetual rest with closed eye and stilled brain. I pray it lives. O corse of the locked tomb, you extemporized wildly, beloved dead, hear your handmaiden. I loved you with my whole rotten, contemptible heart. I loved you to the exclusion of aught else. Let me live long enough to die at your feet.
Then you went under to make war on hell. Hell spat you back out. Fair enough. You did not wake up having passed into the thanagetic space that was the sole province of the dead and the necromantic saints who fought the dead. You woke up in the corridor outside your rooms, on your side, and broiling, gasping for air, soaked right through with sweat, your own, and blood, your own. The blade of your rapier leered through your stomach, punctured through from behind. The wound was not a hallucination or a dream. The blood was wet, and the pain was terrible. Your vision was already curling up black at the edges as you tried to close the rent, tried to sew your viscera shut, cauterize the veins, stabilize the organs whimpering into shutdown. But you were far too gone already. Even if you had wanted it, the imminent death letter would not be yours to read. All you could do was lie gasping in a pool of your own fluids, too powerful to die quickly, too weak to save yourself. You were only half a lictor, and half a lictor was worse than not a lictor at all. Outside the plex, the stars were blocked by the skittering, buzzing heralds of the resurrection beast, beating their wings furiously to roast everything inside. From very far away, you thought you heard the ring of swords, and you flinched at each bright scream of striking metal. You had loathed that sound from birth. You prepared to die with the locked tomb on your lips, but your idiot dying mouth rounded out three totally different syllables, and they were three syllables you did not even understand. Parados. 14 months before the Emperor's murder. In the myriadic year of our Lord, the 10,000th year of the King Undying, our Resurrector, the full pitying prime, the Reverend Daughter, Herohark Nona Jesimus, sat on her mother's sofa and watched her cavalier read. She idly fretted her thumbnail into a decaying brocade skull on the cover, carelessly destroying in a second long years of labour by some devoted anchorite. The mandible unravelled beneath the pad of her thumb. Her cavalier sat very upright in the study chair. It had not taken anyone of comparable bulk since his father's day, and was now in danger of a final fatal sag. He had tucked his considerable frame tight within its borders, as though breaching them might cause incident. And she knew full well that Autus hated incident.
"No retainers, no attendants, no domestics," read Autus Nigenad,
folding the paper with obsequious care.
"Then I will wait on you alone, my Lady Harrowhark?"
"Yes," she said, vowing to keep her patience as long as possible.
"No Marshal Crux, no Captain Iglamine?"
"In fact, no retainers, no attendants, and no domestics," said Harrow, losing her patience. "I believe you've cracked the elaborate code. It will be you, the Cavalier Primary, and me, the Reverend Daughter of the Ninth House. That's all, which I find suggestive." Autus did not seem to find it suggestive. His dark eyes were downcast behind their thick black lashes, the sort Harrowhark had always fancied you might get on some nice domestic mammal, like a hog. He was perennially downcast, and not out of modesty. The faint crow's feet trampling each eye were lines of sadness. The fine creases at his forehead were a careful act of tragedy. She was glad to see that someone, maybe his mother, the mawkish Sister Glorica, had painted his face as his father had once painted his own, with a solid black jaw to represent the mouthless skull. This was not because she had any especial love for the mouthless skull, as paint sacrament went. It was merely because any jawed skull he affected became a wide white skull with depression. After a moment he said abruptly,
"Lady, I cannot help you become a lictor."
She was only surprised that he dared to offer an opinion. "That's as maybe."
"You agree with me? Good. I thank you for your mercy, Your Grace. I cannot represent you in a formal duel, not with the sword, nor the short sword, nor the chain. I cannot stand in a row of cavaliers primary and call myself their peer. The falsehood would crush me. I cannot begin to conceive of it. I will not be able to fight for you, my Lady Harrowhark."
"Autus," she said, "I have known you my entire life. Did you really think I entertained any delusions that you could be mistaken, in the dark, by a dementia-ridden dog raised with no knowledge of bladed objects, for a swordsman?"
"Lady, it is only to honour my father that I call myself a cavalier," said Autus. "It is for my mother's pride and my house's scarcity that I call myself a cavalier. I have none of a cavalier's virtues."
"I am not sure how many times I must relay to you how truly I am aware of that," said Harrowhark, picking a tiny fragment of jet thread from her fingernail. "Given that it has constituted 100% of our exchanges over the years, I can only assume you are coming to some new point and begin to feel excitement." Autus leant forward on the edge of his chair, his restive, long-fingered hands locking together. His hands were big and soft. All of Autus was big and soft, like a squashy black pillow, and he spread them open, beseeching. She was intrigued, despite herself. This was more than he had heretofore dared.
"Lady,"
ventured Autus, voice deepening with timidity,
"I would not venture it, but if a cavalier's duty is to hold the sword, if a cavalier's duty is to protect with the sword, if a cavalier's duty is to die by the sword, have you never considered Autus Nigenad?"
"What?" said Harrow.
"Lady, it is only to honour my father that I call myself a cavalier," said Autus. "It is for my mother's pride and my house's scarcity that I call myself a cavalier. I have none of a cavalier's virtues."
"I feel as though we have had this conversation before," said Harrowhark, pressing her thumbs together, testing with risky pleasure how malleable she might make her distal phalange. One misstep and her nerves might split. It was an old exercise her parents had set her. "Each time the news that you have not spent your life in acquiring martial virtues comes as a little less of a shock to me. But have a go. Surprise me. My body is ready."
"I wish that our house had produced some swordsman more worthy of our glory days," said Autus meditatively, who always found enthusiasm for alternate histories where he was not pressed into service or asked to do anything he found difficult. "I wish that our house had not been diminished to those who are fit but to hold their blade in the scabbard."
Harrowhark congratulated herself on not pointing out how this lack of production was directly due to three things: his mother, himself, and the Noniad. his ongoing verse epic devoted to Matthias Nonius. She had a vile suspicion that the quotation, around which he had somehow contrived to pronounce quotation marks, was from that very same verse epic, which she knew was already on its 18th book, and showed no signs of slowing down. If anything, it seemed to be gaining momentum, like a very boring avalanche. She was composing a rejoinder when she noticed that a serving sister had arrived in her father's library. Harrow had not noticed her knocking, or her passage in. This wasn't the problem. The problem was that the sister's ashen paint was decorating the lovely dead face of the body. Her palms felt wet. In this scenario, either the sister was real and her face was not, or the sister was herself unreal. One couldn't simply gauge all the osseous mass in the room and do a best guess. Bones in meat generated so much deceptive soft phthalogy only a fool would try. She flicked her eyes over to Ortus in the faint hope that he would betray her reality one way or another. But his gaze was still levelled at the ground. "Our house has received good service from those who are fit but to hold their blade in the scabbard," said Harahark, keeping her voice even. "Which is not a line that scans, just so you know. Nobody will be surprised to find you a laggard."
"It's any amateur, the traditional form. Those who are fit but to hold their blade in the scabbard."
"That's not 9 feet of anything.
Never to draw it forth for the battle."
"You will train with Captain Aiglemine for the next 12 weeks, said Harrowhark, rubbing her fingers back and forth, until the pad of her thumb felt very hot. "You will meet the very minimum that is expected of a 9th House Cavalier Primary, which is now, fortunately, that you be as broad as you are tall, with arms that can carry a weight. But I need significantly more from you than the edge of a sword, Nigenad."
The serving sister shadowed the edge of Harrow's peripheral vision. Ortus had raised his head and did not acknowledge the sister, which complicated things. He looked at Harrow with the faint kind of pity she always suspected he held her in, the pity that marked him as an outsider in his own house, and would mark him as all the more an outsider in the house of his mother's line. She did not know what made Ortus Ortus. He was a mystery too boring to solve.
"What more is there?"
he asked, a little bitterly. Harahark closed her eyes, which shut out Ortus's tremulous, worried face and the shadow of the body-faced serving girl that fell over the desk. The shadow told her nothing. Physical evidence was often a trap. She shut out the new and rusty rapier that now creaked in the scabbard at Ortus's hip. She shut out the comforting smell of dust made hot by the whirring heater in the corner of the room, mixing with the just-milled ink in her inkwell. Tannic acid, human salts. "This isn't how it happens," said the body, which gave Harrow a curious strength. "I need you to hide my infirmity," said Harrowhark. "You see, I am insane."
Act 1. Chapter 1. 9 months before the Emperor's murder. It was in the close of the myriadic year of our Lord, that far-off King of Necromancers, that blessed Resurrector of Saints, that you picked up your sword. This was your first big mistake. The sword hated you to touch it. The long hilt burnt your bare hands as though heated to star-like temperatures. The vacuum of space outside yielded no thanergy and generated no thallergy, but it didn't matter. You no longer needed either. You iced your palms over with thick bands of cartilage and you tried again. Now the grip seemed cold as death, and it was just as heavy. You lifted and your elbows locked, and you grasped the pommel to try to steady yourself. You tried a new trick. You slipped a narrow ribbon of bone up from your living metacarpal and eased the fragment gently around the flexor tendon, and you pierced it through the back of your hand. You didn't flinch. It was never your way. From there, you unfolded long fingers of bone to grasp the handle, then more to grasp it again. You lifted it, in a manner of speaking, assisted by a seething, clattering basket of 8 phalanx articulates. So now you could wobble the sword up in an obtuse angle before yourself. You waited. You felt nothing. No understanding, no mastery, no knowledge. You were just a necromancer, and it was just a sword. It fell away from your hands and clattered to the floor, and you folded in half and you upchucked violently all over the hospital tiles. There were many uniformed people in that room, but they were used to these antics. Harrowhark the First, 9th saint to serve the Emperor Undying, might throw up as much as she cared to. You were a walking sacrament. Even if your early contributions to Lictorhood seemed to be finding new and different ways to puke. They only intervened if it looked like you might choke to death on your own vomit, a mercy that you always vaguely thought a shame. The first time the man you called God had delivered you the sword, in what seemed to you his aspect of the kindly prince, intending only gentleness, you'd fallen into a deep stupor from which you had never really risen. Maybe the sword had reified your grief into 6 feet of steel. You had loathed that thrice-damned blade from sight, which might have been unfair before you knew it loathed you in return. You kept trying to wield it, all the same. Each touch ended with the contents of your stomach splattered colourfully on the floor, your days dissolved like ashes in front of a fan, scattered beyond any hope of retrieval, blown back into your face or fluttering upward beyond your grasp. Sometimes you would rise and you'd take up the blade, as though in expectation of something. Nothing ever happened. You felt nothing except the sword's enormous, empty hate of you, which you knew to be real even then. You and the sword would seethe in your mutual bitterness and fury, and then you would end up with blistered hands and a floor's worth of vomit. Details sat at awkward angles to one another. You'd been in this bed some time, wearing clothes that weren't yours. Occasionally, ticklish rasps at your ears or forehead would frighten you numb before you realised it was your own hair. Away from Dreaber shears, it grew in a way that was almost debauched. You would cut it yourself, and still find irregular little licks of it tucked behind your ears. Or maybe you had not cut it at all. Sometimes, in reaching up to it, you would then recall that you had no robe or skeletal mask. Nobody had given you any paint, and there wasn't a stick of grease on board the whole ship, though, even if there had been, it would not have been blessed properly. The first time this happened, in your hot upset and shame, you ripped a sheet to shreds and covered your head with that. This still left most of your forehead nude, discounting the hair. Also, you were wearing a bedsheet. You took the poetic way out and used a black vestal's last choice gambit. You opened a vein, and trembling, neither from pain nor blood loss, daubed blind upon your skin the sacramental skull of the inglorious mask. The uniformed attendants were always busy with things that weren't you. Sometimes you were humbly prevailed upon to sit up and part your ad hoc veil to struggle through a bowl of clear soup, though those memories were doubtful fragments. It did not seem right that you could ever eat again. Sometimes people would move all around you, and you lay supine on your cot, astonished and shivering before the vista of stars out the window. The thick plex barrier seemed too light and frangible to keep you safe. Beyond it, the great black throat of space bared itself to you, which frightened you beyond sense. At these times you fell in and out of sleep somehow. You had long since ceased to care for human voices, which only talked nonsense. They would murmur their prayers of 3,000 units, replenish, that's on the provision list, dump that stock, munitions will take it. In your old life, you might have been curious, but other noises haunted you, quite apart from the ones occurring to your ears. There was a great, unmusical straining aboard ship, the sounds of wet drums, which had panicked you before you'd realized, with settling calm, that you were hearing the heave of 708 beating hearts. You heard 708 brains thrumming in their cerebral fluid. You knew, without checking, that 304 of those straining hearts belonged to necromancers. A necromancer's heart myocardium flexed differently to your ears, worked worse, squeezed more feebly. You were sensing the living. Once you worked out what you were hearing, you became aware of everything immediate to you. The dust settling on the gleaming black plaques of the floor, the roiling of your pulmonaries, the soft marrow of your bones sucking up oxygen. Despite all this cacophony, you could not stay awake. Sometimes you found yourself standing, gorge risen, staring at the great sword left untidy and naked on the floor. You would not remember rising. You would not remember how you had come to be there. Sometimes you would forget who you were, and at recalling yourself, weep like a child. In these digestions of time, the body would come. She would put her cool, dead hands on your forehead and close your pumping eyelids with her fingertips so that you could not see the sword nor the people. This was great honor. This was great mercy. She always came to you now with such easy forbearance, and you were so grateful for it. You were so relieved. The body's hands were grey with death, and they were so soft and familiar on your skin, so much so that you were absolutely sure you could really feel them, that this time around the dead caress was tangible. And when the body turned so that you could see her face, you were amazed as ever by that beauty unblemished by breath. Then she would draw you back to your bed and direct you to sleep. For the body, you tried to be obedient. For once in your benighted life, it seemed beneath you not to. When the body appeared, time could be relied upon to work as it ought, rather than melting away like chips of ice, only to reappear in unexpected places. But at these times, your brain kept nagging itself to stay conscious. The fact that the body had come to you now seemed tremendously important. If only you could stay awake long enough to figure out why. And your face itched from the dried blood, and all around you the people whispered, 1,000 kilos of osseo, old, keep that, that's the first thing we run out of. No, Sergeant, ditch it, we're behind schedule already. Your world was a white and sterile box. This box was the hospital quarter on board the Erebos. The Erebos was the behemoth-class flagship of the Emperor Undying. These facts you held on to like an asphyxiating man to a last lungful of air. You lived in a cool, colourless room of dismantled beds and cartons, and you had for your own a bed and a chair and a sword. They had tried to remove your sword once. They had tried to take it away on some pretext you could not exactly remember, and you were perturbed in some distant way by that memory, which was red and wet and ill-defined. They no longer touched your two-hander. It appeared and reappeared around the room wherever you had dropped it, usually accompanied by the mysterious smell of upchuck. You now slept beside it, like it was your large steel infant. Truth be told, you would have been happy hurling the thing straight into the hot heart of Dominicus, as it was loathsome to you, and you were convinced it wanted to do you harm. But it was very important that it should not be placed in anyone else's hand. This didn't stop you from dulling the blade, nicking the polish, and altogether fucking up the edge, as you vaguely knew you were. You knew so little about swords, you had never bothered to ask. You could barely differentiate between them. Some were narrow, some were broad, some were big, some were small. This two-handed soldier's sword was huge and aberrant, and frankly malicious, and utterly your responsibility, even if you could not touch it without power heaving. Sometimes you knelt by your bed and tried to pray. With the body there, you had nobody to thank and no intercession to request. Your greatest peace you found in that half-asleep, drug-like state on the bed, holding your heartbeat low before the cold white stars, sick with a fury you kept forgetting existed and were corrupted by possessing. Around you, people would go back and forth, giving you the widest berth possible, ignoring you so entirely that at one point you were convinced you were dead. With that conviction, you had felt only intense relief. Chapter 2 God stood in your doorway and said, "You've thrown up again, Harrowhark." You always try to thrust yourself back into full consciousness for the Emperor of the Nine Houses, who regularly had the grace to knock on the door and wait for entry to be granted, proving by itself his divinity. He stood now at the threshold with his ever-present flimsy and ever-present tablet. A cluster of uniformed people tailed him, but his monstrous eyes, oil on carbon, were only for you. "You're losing all your muscle," he said, "and you didn't have much to start with." Your mouth said, with gratifying clarity, "Why does a lictor need a sword? Lord, what use can we have of one? I can control bone. I can shape flesh and evoke spirit. I no longer need outside thanergy. Why anything so crude as a sword?"
"Nice to hear you're feeling better," he said. "I'm not going to talk philosophy with you, not when you've spent the last 3 hours venting your gut."
"Had you?"
"I'm not a monster. Go rinse your teeth. I don't care that you can fill your own cavities. Not looking after those things seems wasteful."
Swaying on your feet, you rose from the bed like a ghost from the tomb and went over to the nearby sink, where you parted your shitty veil and resentfully rinsed your teeth with antiplaque. There was an urgent murmuring from the asteroid belt of aggravated cohort officers, with the Emperor saying, "Yes," then, "No," and, "Don't bother with new plating. They'll be using the Erebos for transport." Another officer said, "My gracious lord, the loyal Saint of Joy
has not yet learned to wait," said God.
"Hold the comms. I answered 3 of them just this morning." "But her order countermands—"
"A lictor's order is the order of God and should be carried out with the same grace you would have honored me with," he said. "Except for right now. Station the last person to graduate Trentum on the Steely and tell them to make static noises if she keeps it up."
"Lord?"
"Air blown through the teeth, tongue high, hand flaps up and down over the mouth. Sounds suspect, I know, but she's never caught on when I've done it."
You spat into the sink. In the mirror, you perceived the body, waiting quietly beside you. She wore a turquoise hospital shift, exactly the same as your own. Her hair shimmered over with frost, her exquisite mouth a hard and ready line. There was a sword strapped to the body's back. You met God's gaze in the mirror, and for a moment you were convinced he could see her too, that he beheld you both. But it was a trick of the eye.
"Harrowhark," he said, I would like you to come with me.
The grave and unslept faces of the officers surrounding him gave a sort of communal wince. One said, very low and very quiet,
Forgive me, kindly prince, but let me bring to your awareness that the Admiral of the Dead Sea and the Admiral of the Ceaseless Fleet began their meeting 10 minutes ago.
The Emperor said,
No meeting will raise 18,000 dead. I need time with Harrowhark the First. Please attend to me in the old chamber 10 minutes hence.
The attachés drifted apart as though they had suddenly lost fixity, all moving down the corridor at barely less than a run.
You were afraid someone might take your sword away from you if you left it.
Rather than lifting it, you lay down next to where it glowered at you blackly from the bed. You rolled over onto its flat steel breadth and bound criss-cross straps of dense bone across your back, around the blade, around the hilt. Straining beneath its weight, with nothing but a ripped-up sheet to mask you, pathetic in your turquoise nudity, you found yourself accompanying the Emperor down long black corridors, trying to fix yourself in time and space. You were basically naked. The sword weighed you down so much that you were affecting a hump. Your inglorious mask was a patchwork of flaking osteology. You looked like an imbecile. God was murmuring to himself,
Please, as though any Admiralty meeting ever ended after 20 minutes.
You said with difficulty,
What is happening to me? You've had a shock, said the Emperor,
which was not an answer, actually.
Does this happen to all new lictors?
Some of them, he said vaguely, which did not fill you with relief. His tablet started to softly peep, and after a cursory glance he shoved it in his pocket.
How are you feeling right now?
You had no room for personal feeling right then. You were assaulted by the sensory data from 708 pulmonary muscles. Everybody on board felt like the awareness of a meal cooking, a good smell, a pillar of something hot and rich. Their thanergy and thallergy rippled in and around each other like a bloom, all like light playing over metal. And there were more. You could hear on the edge of your senses a deeper, sleeping seethe of life and death, a huge body count, but muffled. You felt the dead in some onboard morgue, 10 bundles of discreet dead, of thanergy, with the rot of thallergy arrested, snap-frozen. The stillness of this thanergy was profound. Not even a body in ice was so still. You realized that the body had stopped moving and that the Emperor was waiting quietly for you. You said,
I'm very tired of this convalescence, Lord. If I had it my way, it would take months, not weeks, he said. I would let you come back bit by bit until you felt entirely ready to wake up. I can't. I mastered death, Harrowhark. I wish I'd done the smarter thing and mastered time. I have to ask you to get ready soon, and so I am going to show you something I hope might trigger your readiness.
You were deeply and gravely relieved by his understanding, by his tact. It kept you awake and alive all throughout your trip down the elevator, even though the elevator took full minutes to sail through the enormity of the Erebos. You had never seen anything so fresh and new. You focused on the lovely silver and black chasing on the metal boards, the inlaid panels of rainbow colour, the skull above the door that some artistic adept had fashioned into the skull of the First, someone's bones beautifully moulded into that central sign with the 8 answering houses around it. The skull of your house looked plain and silent next to the others. Soft, dark hangings obscured the plex and the metal and the antiquated LED gleam of electronics. Then the doors whispered open to a cavernous, echoing space where an overhead speaker was announcing, "Our God, the Emperor sees fit to grace the second cargo hold." And you perceived many people moving away, stray cohort officers in their white jackets making themselves scarce, bowing quickly, stopping their work to leave their lord in privacy. Their scuttling footsteps sounded like fleeing animals. You were on a steel-framed balcony, overlooking a field of hundreds and hundreds of oblong boxes. Each was a body long and half a body tall, and all were constructed of bone, their lines and ranks so dizzyingly even that it took you a while to comprehend them, as your eyes kept wavering and crossing. The chill breeze of the recyc air ruffled your smock and goose-pimpled your thighs, but the cold kept you conscious, and you wanted to be conscious. The bone of the boxes gleamed less purely white than the amalgam metal and plasticized panels that made up the sides of the hold, and the bone was topped with a soft, transparent skin, so taut and fine, you could see through it. And through it was "My promised gift, your renewed house," said the Emperor. When he looked at your face, he cautioned you gently. "It's a little under 500, and only a third will display necromantic aptitude, and the same for their next generation. They're all between the ages of 15 and 40, which I thought was easiest." "Oh my God," you said, forgetting that the deity in question was right there. "The ancient dead. You've committed resurrection," he said.
"No, I haven't truly resurrected anyone in 10,000 years, but at that time I set many aside for safety, and I've often felt bad about just keeping them as insurance. They've been asleep all this myriad, Harrow, and it's frankly a relief to my mind to wake them up. I'll begin the process of bringing them to the surface before they're shipped off to the Ninth."
You unpinned your cloth mask so that you could look with your whole face, only a little ashamed to show it so nakedly to the Emperor. He, after all, had seen it before. A sick hope rose in you like nitrogen bubbles in a diver, and you forgot yourself.
"Let me go with them," you said. "Not long, just enough to introduce them to my house, my seneschal. Enough time to tell them..."
"Slow down, Harrowhark," he said. "We must talk, you and I, before you ask me for that. I only wish I had more time to explain."
You took the chilly metal stairs two at a time, feeling your heart ram against serous pericardium, feeling the slim covers of the steps chafing your bare feet. Sharpened by the pain, you wandered between the rows of your silent, sleeping people. You paused over their cradles and stared through the blurry films of skin with their little radiating burses of veins and cells at each face in turn. You tried to commit each one to memory, but their features blended together in one amalgam, one sea of strangers newly Ninth. You drifted a little, overawed and dizzy. The body followed, exactly one half step behind, hand dead calm on the small of your back. The Emperor kept a respectful distance between himself and his handiwork as you and the body peered into each casket. Eventually, the ranks of bone and skin boxes terminated in a clearing of their smaller, more colourful siblings. These were formed of white stone, not osseous matter, and were so freshly carved that the powder of their planing still clung to the sides. They were all of different shapes, some the six-sided funerary box of the deep burial, some the compact hexagon of the ossuary. All were draped in the spectrum of house colours, lacking only black. No empty coffins for your house tonight, except for one plain casket to the side, A little household rose sat atop it, shedding milky blush petals on the stone. These were the corpses you were aware of before, each a crisp, silent slice of thanagy, without even a flicker of bacterial thallergy pattering over their skins. They were statuesque and incorruptible. The Emperor's doing, maybe. But some of them were aberrant. You stared with calm vacuity at a six-sided container draped with the second house's scarlet and white, which had no human remains inside. The single casket, covered in tissue, the gorgeous gold of the third, had no one from the third in residence. Nor could you locate bodies within either of the plain grey-sheeted hexagons intended for the sixth, though there were pitiable scraps and remains in one. Leavings only, much less than a corpse. Something flickered in your nervous system that was a bit like an emotion, but it struggled and died, much to your relief. You were aware of the body standing a little way behind you, quite close beside the Emperor. You said, "How will you explain the missing corpses?"
"Among the dubious privileges of the first house," said God, "is that one is rarely forced to explain."
"The Cavaliers?"
"Have joined their lictors," he said. "It's not really a lie. It's simply a flattening of an awesome and sacramental truth."
You said nothing.
He said, "We went over Canaan House with a fine-tooth comb when we picked you up. We found nobody alive and no more remains, and whatever end came to those we can't account for, if an end has come to them, is a mystery I plan on solving. Until then, I have declared them dead. Call me premature, but I'd rather the houses weep now, Harrowhark, with room for later rejoicing."
It was the plain, uncovered coffin you stared at, the one with the waxy little rose. You suddenly understood which ancient, cancerous corpse was frozen within. Your nervous system tried to process many emotions at once, and then shut down entirely. The body came and turned your face away, but she could not turn back the sudden access of patchwork memory. The Emperor said gently,
"She needs to go home, Harrow."
You did not look.
"And will the seventh house accept her?"
"That was never home," he said. "I am taking Kitherea back to sleep with her brothers and sisters."
You ached. You burnt. The body's fingernails ran a smooth, cool rill down your hot cheek, and she made you look instead at the bone and skin boxes behind you, at the dead, who were only sleeping now, and had been privy to the oldest miracle you knew. Part of your promise had been fulfilled. You wanted to be relieved, but no longer recalled how that worked, glandularly speaking. Now you and God stood facing each other. You could study him without shyness, the shining iridescence of his irises, the unyielding black of the cornea and pupil, the long, square, urbane face. God had very deep lines at his forehead and beneath his eyes. His brows were somewhat sorrowful, but the rest of his face was humorous and mobile, plain and normal. The cool white lights of the docking bay picked out all the parts on his shirt that were shiny with wear, and cast the warm browns of his hands and face into an everyday ochre. If you had seen him and not known, you would have thought him utterly nondescript. But you could not look at him and not know. Terrible divinity clung to his skin.
"You could resurrect them," you said, without bothering to filter much between thought and speech. "You alone are capable of it, but you won't. Why?"
"For the same reason that I haven't for 10,000 years," he said. "For the same reason
that I cannot come back to the Nine Houses. The cost is too great.
You swayed a little. Maybe you fell. The metal grill was beneath your knees, making red sore marks in your flesh. The air through the grate reeking of anti-static pastes. You said into the panels,
"Teach me, Lord, how to count that cost."
God helped you up instead. He put his hands beneath your armpits in a perfectly normal way and raised you to stand and clasped your arms clumsily, a quick, awkward squeeze, as though wanting to comfort and not knowing how, before he took his hands away. He said,
"Harrow, you won't kneel to me. I won't let you. Not until you know exactly what it means when you do it. It hurts me to see you perform obeisance when, if you knew the full story, you might strike me full in the face instead."
You coloured at that and protested.
"My God, and you shouldn't call me God either," he said. "You don't comprehend the word, and I don't want to be God to you yet. You're an invalid, not a disciple. Listen to me. Can you do that? I hate to push you, Herr Arch, but we have so little time."
This was not to be borne.
"I still maintain some of my faculties, Lord." "Well, that's all anyone can hope for," he said.
You propped yourself up against the coffin that did not contain Coronabeth Tridentarius, as it was a heavy slab that couldn't be hurt by your leaning on it. The sword was making your back ache. The kindly prince watched you try to stand, your shoulders bowing beneath the steel, and then he said,
"Harrow, we're still just outside the Dominicus system. Once you're better, we will send the Erebos to the Ninth House, and it will deliver what I said to you it would deliver. Then it will go from house to house to give them back their dead. But I won't be on it. You can choose to part ways with me, or you can come with me as my hand. In a real sense, it's up to you."
You tried to remember what you had said when you had first woken up aboard the Erebos, what you had said when first faced with your resurrector. But you couldn't.
"I chose..." "In ignorance," he said. "It was no choice. Listen."
He went to half lean against the bulkhead closest to the plain coffin, put his tablet atop it, and let his hand rest upon the unadorned surface quite close to the little rose. The Emperor said,
"Harrowhawk, what happens when somebody dies?"
It was a crash question. You ought to have been able to answer it in the same way other people walked or breathed, which was why you found it difficult. The simplicity seemed a trap. You dug your thumbnail into the top of your thigh until it squelched all the capillaries beneath the skin, and you said,
"Apneumatism. The spirit is forced from their body. The initial thanagy bloom occurs."
"Why?"
"Thanagetic decay causes cellular death," you said carefully, pressing the nail in harder, "which emits thanagy. The massive cell death that follows apneumatism causes a thanagetic cascade, though the first bloom fades and the thanagy stabilizes within 30 to 60 seconds.
"What happens to the soul?"
"In the case of gradual death, senescence, illness, certain other forms, transition is automatic and straightforward. The soul is pulled into the river by liminal osmosis. In cases of apneumatic shock, where death is sudden and violent, the energy burst can be sufficient to countermand osmotic pressure and leave the soul temporarily isolated. Whence we gain the ghost and the revenant."
"And what has a soul?" You weren't going to last the distance. The questions were beginning to sound stupid or sophistic. The body watched you with careful, filmy eyes.
"Anything with a thalagetic complexity significant enough to have a soul. So, humanity."
The Emperor drummed his fingertips atop the playing coffin, and he said, a little whimsically, "Why have we not an immortal soul? I would give gladly all the hundreds of years that I have to live to be a human being only for one day." This threw you utterly.
Pardon?
Harrowhark, think, he said, which reminded you very unwelcomely of someone. You gave your thumbnail a better edge, sharpened the dead keratin to a point, and finally drew blood. What else has an enormously complex mass of thallergy? What's the role of a cohort necromancer? Your brain bowed out disgracefully, but something of the old Harrowhark remained, enough to stand there and ask questions. You were grateful for your impertinent ghost self to ask, what was the role of a cohort necromancer? Better to ask the purpose of a cohort swordswoman. To support the necromancer, to provide the death and the thanagy to begin the cycle for necromantic magic to work. Foreign planets were never thanagy planets. They possessed dilute thanagy, of course, but fundamentally, they were thallergenic in character. Send a necromancer down there, and she would be